Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today on the podcast, the second standard operating procedure from the Foundational Stabilization Project, aka FoundStab. Now, the Foundational Stabilization Project is an attempt to set a baseline for emergency care. Now, this baseline shouldn't be low. In fact, this baseline should be higher than what many places are offering, with the idea that if people met these bare minimum standards, then regardless of location, regardless of hospital type, regardless of where you are in the country or the world, you will go into any ED and receive a very good level of care. It doesn't mean certain centers can't provide above that, but we would be very happy to go into any emergency department around the world, receive the care that is suggested by the FoundStab standard operating procedures, and we'd say, okay, I'm good to go here. This one is on the standard intubation procedure. And again, it's an SOP, not a clinical guideline, not a rigid prescriptive situation. There will be variances depending on your individual patient as to whether you want to go with all of the recommendations here, but this should be the baseline. Now, I vetted this one with the Foundational Stabilization team, and they've made fantastic suggestions, but it's still provisional. This is a provisional SOP because, as always, I want post-publication peer review. So I want to hear from all of you. Oh, you missed something, you idiot. Or, yeah, this is really good. Or, hey, what do you think about changing the wording on this? So please comment on everything you hear. Now, before we jump in, real quick, two mentions. One, we have cohort 3 of the Flameproof course. This is the anti-burnout course I do with my buddy Rob Orman. And we take people who are already crispy or who just want to prevent them ever getting to the point where they are not truly enjoying their career. And we run them through a 12-session video course with us live. And the curriculum is amazing. Things like inner voice work, agency, how to have flow and joy on shift, how to deal with difficult consultants, and so much more. And the first two cohorts loved it. The feedback we've gotten has been amazing. So if you're interested in that, flameproofcourse.com, flameproofcourse, all one word, .com. And then a two-second mention of, we're still selling tickets for the 10th iteration of our Reanimate course, our resuscitative ECMO course, which is one of the most fun things I do every year. That'll be in November in San Diego. You can find out more about that at reanimateconference.com. Okay, let's jump back in. So the SOP for standard intubation, who does this pertain to? It is for adults. We have not done the peds stuff yet. Maybe that'll be a project after this initial adult found stab project. So they are adults greater than, I don't know, what, 16? Somewhere in that range where you consider them, oh, clearly everything about them is an adult. They are acceptable for RSI or DS, meaning you've done a difficult airway assessment. You've decided I'm not going down an awake pathway. So I'm going to RSI this patient. I'm going to DSI this patient. And then last but not least, they are without special circumstances that will dictate different strategies. For instance, you determined that they were an anatomically difficult airway, or that they're grossly physiologically unstable, or they're a neurocritical care intubation, or anything along those lines where you don't want to use a standard intubation SOP. Now we have 23 recommendations for this one. It's big because I see so much care that is bad, that without much money could be repaired. And it just doesn't happen. And in fact, as I was vetting this with the core team, some of the people didn't actually even realize some of the important things on this, even though they are providing insanely high levels of care. So that's why there's so many on here. And I don't think many of the SOPs will be this long, but I think it's really important here. And I've devoted my career to improving airway management. That is my main niche. And so I really care about this. And I think each and every item on here is vital. And if you're not already doing it, it can be game-changing for both your success, but also for keeping the patient safe while intubating. All right, we'll start off with the category of equipment. So number one, all equipment for intubation and failed airway management should be stored in an immediately accessible and ready-to-use system. Now, what do I mean by this? I've gone to EDs and critical care units where Everything is just in a jumbled box or cart that is randomly restocked, and everything is in random places, and you have to go for a shopping expedition before you intubate a patient. And the goal of this rec, number one, is that if you had a patient whipped in by EMS with no pre-notification at all, and they're bagging this patient, you would be able to go from nothing to intubating with rapidity, meaning everything is set up in as easy to use a system as possible. Now, I am biased on this next little piece of this because I actually designed a dump kit specifically to address this. So here's a conflict of interest warning. The dump kit I designed has everything ready to go for an intubation such that you could just open the bag, put it down on a table, and you're good. And then you do all the restocking, the shopping expedition after the intubation to restock that bag. I think this is a game-changing system, and I strongly recommend it. You don't have to use that. Some hospitals have tackle boxes, and they're always seemingly orange tackle boxes, that have all the equipment for one intubation in it, and then you send that back down to central supply. Now, those are slightly inferior because you don't have everything prepped. You still have to open the ET, open the stylets, and do all that, but it's very good. What you can have is just some random tackle box that's stocked by your people in the ED where, oh, it doesn't look like there's enough ET tubes, let me throw in a random assortment. You want something that is single patient use so that every single intubation, every item that you would want is in that box. And I strongly recommend that you talk to your central sterile people and have them put the difficult airway equipment in there as well. Meaning, for me, a size 4 iGel extraglottic airway, a scalpel, and a bougie. And then I know if I open that orange tackle box, I have everything I need to go ready for me. I don't have to go looking. I don't have to go shopping. All of the equipment is there. You should have the tube securing device as well in that orange tackle box if you can, if it could fit. All right. The next piece of this is that you already have a suction set up and ready to go, preferably two set up and ready to go. You need two suctions for the intubation, but having at least one set up and ready to go so that if EMS brings a patient in with their mouth full of vomit and they're bagging that patient, you don't have to struggle to get a suction set up. One should be there, good to go. And then I strongly prefer having a BVM set up, ready to go. Meaning, I take it out of its package, I expand it if it's all folded in on itself. I put the mask on, I put a PEEP valve on, and then I put it back in its bag and I attach it to oxygen and I have it hanging on that oxygen flow meter such that if I need to use that BVM emergently, all I have to do is take it out of its bag and turn on the oxygen. So that's number one. Number two, waveform capnography should be immediately available in the standard locations for intubation. Meaning, I think every ED should have at least one, if not more, rooms where this is where we resuscitate and this is where we preferentially intubate. EDs that are just using, oh, you can intubate in any bed, means you really are not doing good intubation at any bed. That is the way that works. So having a designated set of resus rooms where patients are brought over for their intubation is markedly safer in my estimation. And once you have those rooms, and you should, then you should have end-tidal CO2 sitting there ready to go with the soft supplies all like right next to where you're going to plug them in such that you don't have to go looking so that end-tidal CO2 is immediately available. Number three, attach end-tidal CO2, meaning the waveform end-tidal CO2 device and a PEEP valve to the BVM prior to intubation. So when you're ready to intubate, your BVM should have a PEEP valve on it. Why? Because A, this prevents entrainment of room air for that have bad exhalation valves. And two, it allows for the provision of PEEP when you need it, which when you have a patient who has had a sudden initiation of shunt physiology, for instance, because they've had atelectasis or they've had aspiration, you now can immediately ameliorate that situation without having to go searching for a PEEP valve. The one place it's supposed to be in that resus room, it just turns out to be empty. You're hosed. Someone has to go to a stock room and find that patient's not going to do well. So having the PEEP valve on makes a ton of sense. And like I said, I'd like to have the BVM prep with that before a patient ever arrives. And then end-tidal CO2 guarantees that you will monitor each breath that you administer with that BVM even before an endotracheal tube is in. So if you have to reoxygenate a patient with a BVM, you want to know whether those breaths are going in. So you want to have that end-tidal CO2 on the BVM prior to intubation, not after you get the tube in. Number four, have all failed airway equipment present at the bedside, not you have to go looking for it when you need it. Meaning, an oral airway, a properly sized extraglottic airway, and I take no money from iGel, but I like to have a size 4 iGel because it fits pretty much any patient. But you could use whichever extraglottic devices you like. A bougie, And then whatever you would use for surgical airway in terms of your tube device, whether that's for me a 6.5 ETT or a 6.0 trach, preferably one with a small outer diameter, which in the US means a Portex trach. I don't take money from Portex either. And then a backup direct laryngoscope. And these should all be present at the bedside. Now, if you have a dump kit, then they're automatically going to be present at the bedside. If you have a stocked intubation tackle box for single use, they're all going to be at the bedside because you've gone to Central Sterile and say, here's the things I need. I need to have the backup laryngoscope. I need all of these difficult airway equipment devices already in the box. All right, number five, place the equipment on a table rather than the patient's bed or body. This is key. And if you don't subscribe to this, then you will inevitably, at the moment you finally get a glimpse of the cords in a really unexpectedly difficult intubation, that bougie or ET tube will be on the floor, guaranteed. That's just how Murphy plays. Your job is to circumvent Murphy. Number six, have properly labeled medications at the bedside for intubation, hemodynamic rescue, and post-intubation sedation. Now, what does this mean? It means you have your intubation meds, obviously, but they're labeled in a milligram per ml fashion, and you have a full syringe of those drugs. I am strongly against the idea of, hey, doc, how much ketamine and how much rock do you want? Unless the patient is morbidly obese and therefore you need far more than the standard. But in the standard situation, I want a full syringe of ketamine and a full syringe of my paralytic or muscle relaxant. And then, since they're labeled properly, milligram per ml, at the moment I'm actually pushing the medications, I could determine how much of those meds I want to give. The hemodynamic rescue means I strongly think you should have push-dose epinephrine present at every intubation, already drawn up. And then post-intubation sedation, we know if people have to go looking for it after the patient's intubated, especially if they're have received rocuronium because they just don't, the patient doesn't tell you how miserable they are. It takes longer. We have evidence for this, that it takes longer to get those patients properly sedated. So having the sedation at the bedside, absolutely key. Now, obviously, if it's a crash intubation, you just grab the intubation meds as quickly as possible, and then they could be getting the sedation meds as you're intubating. But in the optimal situation, everything's prepared at the bedside, ready to go. I also like to have norepinephrine at the bedside for all my patients. That doesn't have to be there before you start intubating. But certainly when I tell them for a patient that doesn't need a crash intubation, what meds I want, I tell them the intubation meds, the push-dose epinephrine for rescue, the sedation meds, and a norepi drip. And that gives them the optimal time, our nursing colleagues, to prepare all of those medications. All right, now we're in the category of preparation for intubation. So number seven, place patient in optimal positioning. And this should be done before the pre-oxygenation because pre-oxygenation becomes better when you do that. Now, I've done entire episodes on this, but very briefly, that means ears to sternal line, not sternal notch. Sternal notch gets obviated if you change the head of the bed positioning. It no longer works. So sternal line, that's the line between your xiphoid process and your manubrium. You extend that imaginary line ad infinitum, and then the ears should be at or above that level. Face plane parallel to the ceiling. Now, plus or minus slightly raising the head of the bed. In most cases, 20 degrees, which is very minimal, does good things for the patient's physiology. Beyond that, you are now doing a trade-off between optimizing the patient's lungs from the perspective of atelectasis and preferentially sending the gas to the places you want it versus making the intubation potentially more difficult from the positioning standpoint. But I think everyone could be in a 20-degree head-up position without any real problem. Number eight, use an effective pre-intubation oxygenation optimization strategy. Now, why would I call it that? Why can't I just call it pre-ox? The reason I call it POO, pre-intubation oxygenation optimization, is because pre-ox in the airway literature refers solely to denitrogenation. But we want to go beyond denitrogenation to also keeping the patient's lungs as fully inflated as possible prior to the intubation. So pre-intubation oxygenation optimization encompasses that. So what will actually get you there? The first one, the first option, and the one I think you should take in many places, is a non-rebreather at greater than or equal to 50 liters per minute. You may be like, Scott, I don't have a flow meter that goes that high. Mine goes to 15. Yes, all of them go to 15, unless you buy a high flow optimized flow meter. And I think you should in your intubation rooms have those, but you don't need it. If you're in the US and Canada, if you keep turning that dial counterclockwise as far as it goes, then you are getting flush rate greater than 50 liters per minute. And that's what you want. And so as long as you open that all the way in the US and Canada, in every flow meter that I have seen, you will be good to go. And you'll know it's going to sound like a jet engine, right? Now, if you're in Australia and New Zealand, I believe, theirs only go at flush rate. They go from the 15 that's measured on the flow meter to 20. Not going to do it for just a non-rebreather alone. For that, you want a combination of a nasal cannula at that 20 and a non-rebreather at greater than or equal to 20. And it is safe. We have evidence that nasal cannula that high, it's not going to hurt anyone. It's a little loud and a little bit drying, but it's fine. Those two in tandem, not quite as good as the non-rebreather flush rate, but very acceptable. Another option, BVM plus nasal cannula plus PEEP valve. That is a fantastic option. You need the nasal cannula there to take advantage of the PEEP valve, and it's going to deal with any leaks. So it's really optimal to not just have a BVM and a PEEP valve, but a BVM nasal cannula and PEEP valve, and put the nasal cannula at 15, 10 or 15 will get you where you need to go. It'll power the PEEP valve, and it will take care of any leaks around that mask as you're pre-oxygenating. A non-invasive machine or a vent will do a fantastic job, but that's pretty complicated. So you have to really decide if that's a great way to go. And if you're outside the US or you're an anesthesiologist, a Mapleson circuit or any of the variants on that is fine as well. If that doesn't get you to a saturation of 100%, then as long as the patient's hemodynamics will allow it, adding some PEEP to the mix can be very beneficial to take care of shunt physiology. And that means switching from whatever you were using to a BVM with the nasal cannula and PEEP valve, and then dialing up the PEEP valve on that, or dialing up the PEEP on a Mapleson circuit, or if you're already using it, then just dialing up the PEEP on your non-invasive machine or your ventilator. Number 9, patients should have a nasal cannula at greater than or equal to 15 liters per minute in place throughout the intubation procedure. Now, this is really doing two things for you. One is it is giving you the benefits of apneic oxygenation. Now, in emergency and critical care intubations, apneic oxygenation is variably effective. We know it works on elective patients coming to the operating room. Definitively, it works. It will work on some ED patients who don't have shunt physiology. ED patients that do will not have as effective an oxygenation from apneic oxygenation. You still might as well have it, but that's not why I really recommend it. The reason I really recommend it is that this will power a PEEP valve for any attempts at reoxygenation that you need during the intubation attempt and during the apneic period. What this will allow you to do is have, without having to bag, though it'll be just as effective while bagging, PEEP being administered to that patient, which will not work with a low flow device like a BVM or even a non-invasive machine or vent very well without high flow. And the high flow is provided by the nasal cannula. So for two reasons, AppOx and the capability of providing high flow CPAP during the intubation and reoxygenation, I strongly recommend having a nasal cannula at greater than or equal to 15 liters per minute. Number 10, perform physiologic and hemodynamic stabilization prior to intubation whenever possible. Now, if it's a crash intubation that you can't temporize, then you got to do what you got to do. But in every other situation, Rich Levitan's exhortation of resuscitate before you intubate is absolutely key. Meaning, okay, they're MAPS 65, they're good to go. No, they're going to drop during the intubation. So make that better. If they're profoundly acidotic, then blow them down prior to the intubation. Do everything you can to optimize their oxygenation before the intubation. So resuscitate before you intubate. Number 11, perform a checklist timeout prior to intubation. Performing shops, high performing services, all are using checklists. And you might be like, that's great for them, but I'm just in a rural ED one doc shop. I don't need to do this. I would say that you probably are intubating less often than the places that are incredibly high performance. You need a checklist even more. And there's so little downside. It takes no time at all. Make an institution-specific checklist. You could use mine as a template. The checklist should have items that you're not going to do automatically. You don't need on the checklist to have a laryngoscope at the bedside because you're going to remember that. But remembering to put a PEEP valve on your BVM, that's the kind of thing that should be on a checklist, right? So make one. Make it as easy as you possible, but no simpler than is necessary to get all the items that are absolutely key on there and just run through it. You could have your nurse do it as a call response like we do where they just read through the checklist and you say check, check or yes. And it takes 30 seconds unless you forgot something. Then it takes more time because the items that are critical for that intubation have been forgotten. And so it's key that it takes more time. It's a good thing. It's a win when it takes longer than the 30 seconds. All right, number 12, verbalize an airway algorithm, which means say it to the whole room so they could keep you honest as the intubator. And this is super quick. I use the modified MCRT modified shock trauma algorithm. You could find that on the site in the show notes for this episode. But basically what it means is the intubator is verbalizing, I'm going to take three attempts at laryngoscopy, changing something between each attempt. If that fails or the patient desaturates, I'm going to place an extraglottic airway. And if that fails, I'm going to perform a surgical airway. And that's it. And now everyone in the room knows the plan. And if you go for that fourth attempt, they could hopefully say, they could speak up and say, doc, hey, shouldn't we place that supraglottic airway? Because this will be the fourth attempt. And you'd be like, oh, crap, I'm being kept honest. I can't do something stupid that while you're in the spiral of continued attempts at laryngoscopy, you might not realize. All right, now we're in the intubation procedure itself. Number 13, perform RSI or DSI using ketamine, and which is the preferred, or succinylcholine. Now, I really spent a lot of time thinking, should DSI just become the standard recommendation? And I, in my heart, feel it should. With DSI, in this case, being simply a two-second pause after pushing the ketamine and saying, should I push the muscle relaxant? That's a final check. It doesn't mean you're actually waiting between each attempt. But after speaking to numerous smart people, I'm leaving it as RSI or DSI as the standard, whichever you prefer in the individual patient or in your institution. I think it's pretty clear at this stage of the game, ketamine is the default. It doesn't mean you can't use other medications given different circumstances. I think ketamine makes a lot of sense. I think the suggestive literature saying etomidate increases mortality in critically ill intubations should push you to using ketamine. Now, I strongly prefer ROC for countless reasons that I've mentioned prior in prior episodes on the show. But if you want succinylcholine across the board or just for this individual patient, I think it's acceptable. But ROC makes a lot more sense in many of the circumstances. All right, number 14, unless contraindicated, provide gentle ventilation during the apneic period. Now, if the patient has they're ready to burst from a small bowel obstruction or a GI bleed that you haven't decided to put an NG tube in prior to intubation, then don't bag them. But in almost every case, the data from the PREVENT trial, I think, would tell us, which is the multicenter RCT on this, that the patient's going to do much better from an oxygenation perspective if you bag them during the apneic period. And this doesn't mean a lot. It's basically in the 60 seconds you're waiting after the ROC, you give them, I don't know, five breaths? Just really nothing, because you're not caring about ventilation in these standard intubations. A metabolic acidosis patient is different. You just need them to have enough to continue to oxygenate, and that doesn't require very much. That's 250 cc's for a minute, and they're good to go. So basically, one breath would be enough. You don't have to give that few breaths. You can give, you know, four or five breaths, and they're fantastic. Use video laryngoscopy for all intubations. I hope that this is no longer contentious. The evidence is overwhelming. And especially for people that don't perform frequent intubations, it is absolutely key to use video laryngoscopy. Now, I'm not going to be prescriptive in this SOP as to whether you use standard geometry or hyperangulated. I think you can make arguments for both. But I think it has to be video. It has to be video. And if you're like, I'm going to lose my direct skills, first of all, why do you still want direct skills? Because the skills you get with video are perfectly applicable to direct when you need it. If you have to intubate in CT scan and you've just done the past 200 intubations with a video device, you'll be better than the person who just did the past 200 intubations with a direct device at direct laryngoscopy. And I will happily debate anyone who disagrees with that. But if you really wanted to maintain your skills, then just look in the mouth with your video device and only have the screen there to look up at as a backup. But I don't think there's any reason for that. It should all be done with a video looking at the screen, in my opinion. All right. Number 16, consider a bougie with first pass if using standard geometry video blades. And I think the evidence we have for this fully supports this. You will not get first pass success rates greater than 95% without a standard geometry video plus a bougie. And that's what Driver's original trial showed us. And I think if you're using standard geometry, there's no reason not to use a bougie, because you will not be ready to use a bougie unless you use a bougie as much as possible when you actually need to use it to rescue a failed airway. Number 17, perform optimization maneuvers prior to abandoning attempts if the patient remains well saturated, which means I can't see anything, I'm just going to come out. No, there's things you could do. And look at the episode on the Kovach-Kata if you are curious about this. But for me, it's neck, head, hand, scoop, pull back, meaning bimanual laryngoscopy on the thyroid cartilage, lifting the head even further than optimal positioning if necessary, using two hands to lift if you're not getting adequate head lifting force, and then retaining that view with one arm. Scooping the epiglottis if you have a grade 3 view that is preventing visualization of the glottic structures from the epiglottis. And then if you are using a hyperangulated blade or some of the disposable standard geometry blades and you have over-rotated on your insertion, pull back to allow a crappier view that allows you to actually place the tube or bougie in. Number 18, use large bore suction catheters. Now, this is absolutely key. Yankauers are built to do direct pressure on bleeds during tonsillectomies. They were never meant to suction up vomit. They were meant to suction up thin blood and use as a source of providing pressure to airway structures to stop bleeding during tonsillectomies. They were never intended for the purpose we use them for. We have purpose-built large bore suction catheters, and I do not take any support from the S-Core Corporation, but the Ducanto suction catheter from my friend Jim Ducanto is perfect for this. It is large bore. It sucks better. We have evidence for this. It allows you to intubate with a bougie by placing this into the glottis. It brings so much to the table that you should just buy them. And you don't have to buy them to replace all of the catheters in your entire ED. Use the cheap Yankauers for regular stuff, like just suctioning out a non-intubation patient. Have these reserved, maybe in your tackle box that the central supply people send you, such that you will have one of these at the bedside for every intubation, and you won't be wasting money for just using them for suctioning up spit on routine patients. Number 19, we're now into reoxygenation and failed intubations as a category. Number 19, perform BVM breaths with a two-hand mask grip, oral airway, and end-tidal CO2 confirmation of every breath. Now, this is going to require someone else to squeeze the bag. They don't have to be skilled. It could be anyone. It could be a very skilled person like your RT. It could be a clinical nursing assistant who has no idea, but they are just, you just tell them, hey, every 6 seconds, just gently squeeze this bag. And if they squeeze too hard, then you just tell them, hey, squeeze a little lighter next time. But you are providing the actual skilled technique, which is holding two hands on the mask. Now, I prefer a thumb forward grip, and use an oral airway, not just because it keeps the tongue out of the way, because your jaw thrust should do that, but because it keeps the mouth from closing as you pull the head into the mask. It keeps the mouth open. And then every breath you give should be with end-tidal CO2 confirmation. And so you should be looking at the monitor with each breath saying, oh, look, I see an end-tidal CO2 waveform after the breath. I know they're going in. Because sometimes there'll be pulse ox lag and the patient's sats won't move for 60 to 120 seconds. So you want to know these breaths are going in. Number 20, do not perform more than 3 attempts at laryngoscopy without a cognitive and physiologic reset from extraglottic airway placement, which means if you have failed 3 attempts, then you need to place that supraglottic or extraglottic airway. Once it's in, if you temporize that patient, end-tidal CO2, and you see the sats have come up, you need to now re-perform denitrogenation. That has to go on for 3 minutes at least. And you have to calm down. You have to dump your stress response, get all of the epi and norepi out of your system, reset all of your equipment. And then if you or a partner want to take another laryngoscopy attempt, that's acceptable. For me personally, what would I do? I would take a disposable or reusable bronch and intubate through the supraglottic airway at that point. There's various techniques to do that. But if you wanted another laryngoscopy attempt, the patient has now been fully reset, you've been fully reset, that is acceptable, especially if you figured out what was going wrong up until that moment. 21, perform a surgical airway if laryngoscopy and extraglottic airway placement do not provide end-tidal CO2 waveform and acceptable saturations. All right, you just got to do it. 3 attempts at laryngoscopy, supraglottic airway, that fails, or at any point you can't get the sats greater than 93%, then you should be performing a surgical airway. And this means, in contradistinction to something like the vortex approach, that just being able to maintain saturations with a BVM does not get you out of performing an extraglottic airway and then a supraglottic and then a surgical airway. In fact, those BVM attempts that are maintaining sats are what allows you to safely perform a surgical airway. Number 22, confirm placement with waveform end-tidal CO2. This is it. This is the standard. You need to have waveform end-tidal CO2. It means you might, in a rural place, just buy one portable machine that you could bring anywhere. It might mean that you have one room that has a setup for end-tidal CO2, and you have a portable machine if you intubate anywhere else. But you need every intubation confirmed with waveform end-tidal CO2. And last but not least, number 23, perform a debrief after every airway management. Now, you might be, I'm a single doc shop. Why do I need to debrief? Then it should be a solo debrief in your own head. You don't even have to verbalize it, which means, okay, what went well, what didn't? And now I strongly recommend, since we're using video, that you record all of your own intubations. And part of your debrief should be watching that and saying, ooh, I got it, but my technique wasn't perfect. Here's how I'm going to improve it next time. But I think you should reflect on each and every intubation attempt. Now, if there were other people involved, whether there are other docs or not, and something could have gone differently, then you should definitely do a formal debrief with those people and say, look, I just want to take 1 minute here, talk about the airway. What went well? What do you folks think could be improved? And it might be something as simple as the intubation meds weren't given to us in a clear fashion, or someone pushed the ketamine and then didn't push the rock, and we didn't realize it until 2 minutes later. Whatever, that kind of debrief improves care. And it might be just doing a formal debrief on every intubation simply to say, folks, you did a fantastic job at facilitating this. Thank you. Thank you for your help. Thank you for your alacrity. That alone will improve morale, improve the ideas that go into this. So please consider performing a debrief after every airway management, whether you have a big team or it's just you, a nurse, and an RT. I still think it's worth spending those 60 seconds. All right, so there you go. There are the pieces of the SOP. Now, I'm sure some of these are going to be controversial. So put your comments in, and then I'll probably wind up doing a follow-up show on this one, discussing all the commentary that came through and my rationale. And that allowed me to keep it a little bit shorter because I haven't gone over all of the evidence base for all these recommendations because they're in various MCRIT episodes. So if you see anything, you're like, what? That's crazy. We can't bag during the apneic period. Then mention it. And we'll talk about that in more depth, even though I've gone over it in previous podcasts. But I'll put out a follow-up episode to this SOP with all of the responses to all the various comments that come through. Now, of interest, as I was in the midst of cogitating on this, and it's been months because this one is really tough for me because there's so many things that I would do, like DSI across the board, that I don't want to recommend as part of the SOP. So I've been thinking back and forth. And as I was doing that, a society called the European Society for Emergency Medicine came out with a set of their intubation guidelines in response to the Society of Critical Care Medicine guidelines that I think is pretty damn good. There's a few things I would quibble there, but for the most part, they're pretty excellent. I wonder if any of the authors are MCRIT listeners, because there's so much synchronicity with their guidelines and the way I think, which is divergent from a lot of EM and critical care. So I'd be curious if any of them are MCRIT listeners, or it was just that good ideas emerge regardless of their source, and therefore we came to many of the same conclusions. But hat tip to Cliff Reed, whose video showed me these guidelines, and then I took a look, and I'm like, wow, these are pretty damn good. So I think we could probably bring this to a close there. You could actually see the guidelines in writing on the show notes for this episode, mcrit.org/372. It's a lot easier, I think, for people to process after listening to then go back and actually look at the individual guidelines. You might have quibbles with the wording, so that would be fantastic if you took a look and said, no, I totally agree with this, but I think you should word it a little bit better. Let's see, is there anything else I need to mention? No, again, thank you to the FoundStab team. If you're interested in contributing, if you're interested in getting early vision of these SOPs as they develop so that you could have commentary prior to them being put out here in their provisional form, then just send me an email, mcrit.org/contact, and I'll put you on the roster. And let's see, anything else for me to hit? No, I don't think so. So with that, I will wrap it up as I always do to just give you a reminder of Medicine, my coaching service for physicians and other clinicians, where we take both people on the negative end, people burnt out or people who have behavioral issues at their hospital, and we make them better, or we take people who are already super on the positive side of their careers, and we force multiply them to be even more potent with things like productivity, leadership counseling, mindset work, productivity, and performance. So if you're interested in that, mcrit.org/coach. And as mentioned at the top of the show, Flameproof Course, our anti-burnout course, flameproofcourse.com, and Reanimate, our resuscitative ECMO course at reanimateconference.com. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye. You hate that sound. I hate that sound. Why are you hearing that sound? You're hearing that sound because you are a unpaid listener to MCRIT, and yet this is one of those episodes where only the team members, the MCRIT members get the full episode, which means you're missing out on tons of resuscitative goodness. You're missing out on the optimal way to care for your super sick patients. And it's sad because just going to mcrit.org/join would allow you to get full access, to get access to the RAC literature reviews, full episodes, extra goodies, bonus stuff for an incredibly inexpensive price. Your department will pay for it, or you could write it off on your taxes. You could get it done before the end of the year and become a full MCRIT member. Just go on over to mcrit.org/join, and you will now be someone exposed to all of the information to take care of your super sick patients that you want. You'll get this full episode and be able to actually perform a retrograde intubation. You'll be happy. So just go on over to mcrit.org/join and never hear this message again.